This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Before we get to my conversation with Tom Hazlett, I want to tell you about a new documentary-style podcast series that takes an in-depth look at the history of the Constitution. It's from the legal minds over at the Institute for Justice, so right away you know it's going to be good. It's called Bound by Oath, and it features interviews with historians, legal scholars, and the real people involved in historic and contemporary cases. Bound by Oath. Go check it out. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. What a difference a decade makes. 10 years ago or so, everyone seemed to love big tech companies like Google, Facebook, and Amazon. But nowadays, those same corporations are the favorite targets of politicians on all ends of the political spectrum. Donald Trump rarely goes a day without inveighing against tech giants for allegedly screwing with his popularity and his reelection possibilities, and Democratic presidential candidates such as Elizabeth Warren have promised to break up companies that they say have too much cultural, economic, and political power over us. Behind all of this is a recent interpretation of antitrust law that is sometimes called hipster antitrust because it's being touted by a new, younger generation of legal scholars. In the October issue of Reason, Clemson economist and longtime Reason contributor Thomas W. Hazlett delves into the ideas and analysis that hipster antitrust comes up with, and he criticizes the new push for breaking up tech giants. He says that the hipster antitrust scholars and people like Warren and Trump have got it almost completely wrong, and that companies such as Amazon actually are massively benefiting consumers. So on today's Reason podcast, I'm going to talk with Hazlett about the history of antitrust and the future of free markets, both here in the United States and abroad. Tom Hazlett, thanks for talking to Reason today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Nick.
Let's get to it. Hipster antitrust law, what is it and where does it come from?
So it's new, but it has a rich history. The new dimension is that just in the last couple of years, almost bursting on the scene and led by a law student at Yale who published a very persuasive article that's taken the world by storm, gone viral, as is not often seen in the law journal business. In 2017, Amazon's Antitrust Paradox by Lina Khan, and it really has inspired a lot of thinking and created buzz about the tradition of antitrust that is most commonly associated with Louis Brandeis, late Supreme Court justice and prolific author and lawyer, graduate of Harvard Law School, the author essentially of the Federal Trade Commission Act, 1913-14. And he had a very profound effect on many aspects of American law, including antitrust. But he was not in the middle or a little over to one side. He was very much of the big is bad school.
And he used the phrase, the curse of bigness, right, to kind of demonize large monopolies or cartels at the time.
Well, he actually wasn't so opposed to cartels because he thought that coordination and even protection by law, the small dealers and worthy men, as Supreme Court Justice Peckham called them, the smaller enterprises that were getting challenged and in many cases displaced by the large, efficient, nationally integrated firms rising in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that cartels might be quite all right. And in fact, the efficiencies of the large firms, the firms producing at scale and with new forms of integration across different segments of production, that those companies were lowering prices and endangering the old system and the small merchants and local dealers. And so that kind of world had to be protected for economic and political reasons.
So in a way, Brandeis was kind of, he was definitely trying to protect, this is an anachronistic term, but artisanal kind of shops, companies that were big and might be locally powerful and things like that, but that couldn't withstand the onslaught of, you know, Standard Oil or, you know, large national companies like you're talking about.
Sure. I think it's fairly safe to say he would have been protesting Walmart in the 1990s and 2000s. Mm-hmm. And protecting what he thought to be a better form of organization for society, to have small bookstores and shops and a small business. And he was quite explicit in his not just protestation, but detestation of the consumer buying cheaply, always shopping for quality, trying to get the better deal. Because, yes, customers were trying to take advantage of economies of scale. And they were being offered such, of course, by these newly emergent large firms. So that combination in the marketplace, gains from trade, was a threat he saw might be answered by a very aggressive antitrust policy that tried to cap the size of firms and in fact, discriminate against the large-scale enterprise in favor of small-scale.
Before we get into the way that a kind of Brandeis's essential insights are being applied in the name of hipster antitrust, let's focus a little bit on this old tradition. At the time, you know, and this is what the 19-teens and 1920s that Brandeis is really kind of articulating this type of stuff. And then when he gets on the Supreme Court and, you know, actually starts being able to rule in antitrust cases, I suppose, was the common understanding that, you know, that lower prices were always a good thing? Or did he have to argue against that? Because today we kind of take for granted the idea that, well, you know, the reason why Walmart has, you know, has such a massive market share is because they, you know, they can get, you know, the same product or similar products to people for much cheaper. And that, of course, customers are right to go for the cheapest product. Was that the common understanding of kind of the benefits of capitalism in the early part of the 20th century?
Well, it was. That's always, of course, been an evident advantage when you do have the efficiencies that develop through the Industrial Revolution that indeed customers get a higher standard of living precisely because the prices they pay, both in real dollars or currency and in terms of the hours they have to work in the marketplace to afford these products, have been dropping. And so this has been a fairly straightforward benefit of competition in the marketplace. At the same time, there has always, from antitrust debates in the 1890s and forward, been some concern about overly vigorous competition that does impose upon the competitors. So this is the reaction today to the formulation in previous decades, even centuries. Mm-hmm. But it came to a head in 1978 when Robert Bork, the famous Yale law professor who was put on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, but Bork's very influential 1978 book, The Antitrust Paradox, drew out the conflict between protecting competition, which lowers prices and expands quality and output for consumers, and protecting competitors, which in fact might freeze prices at higher levels and stymie innovation, which can push some of the less efficient competitors out of the market. In fact, that's one of the indexes. You know, do you have entry by more efficient systems and exit by the less? So that has been a debate, and Bork faulted the antitrust law as being often on the side of the incumbent, inefficient incumbent in the marketplace and directly against the consumer's interest.
I just wanted to make sure I understand this because you are both an economist by training and you teach law and economics. So I'm not sure I'm always following the technical aspects, but part of what Bork was saying and other people say is that antitrust law often tries to say a market is competitive if you have five or six firms competing for market share, whereas Bork is saying that, in fact, competition might be better served or the consumer might be better served if you have one giant company that is acting as if it's competing against existing or future competitors and is delivering better prices and better service at lower cost.
Yeah, that's not far away in terms of, well, are you going to count competitors to establish whether there's competition? In fact, a lot of people might say five is a small number. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're talking about a commodity sector or something where there could be many more players, the basic break is to say, well, if there are a lot of competitors in a market, that might be sufficient for competition, but it's not necessary. That is to say, better methods, economies of scale, new business models might come in and actually produce better products and tend to concentrate the market. So you might drop down from five to four to three, maybe two, as you suggest, even one in some situations, depending upon how the market is defined, of course. That's always the 800-pound gorilla lurking in the corner. But the issue, and this has been very persuasive in the United States and around the world, although really the U.S. leading the world here, the real focus in antitrust policy has been to improve consumer welfare. And so that would be lower prices, higher quality, more output in the market, so that, in fact, you have more productivity and consumers enjoy benefits on net. And that's, of course, adjusting for quality and the valuation that the customer herself puts on these products. It's not something imposed from without the system or by an economist or a government regulator. So that's been the direction we're in. And the hipster antitrust is a reaction against that. They, in fact, say that we spent too much time worrying about consumer welfare. We should worry much more about the numbers and the long-run implications of having innovation come in and, with a company like Amazon, have low prices, come to have a large position in online retailing, and therefore make economic and business decisions without the benefit of a large number of competitors competing at exactly the same price.
So you mentioned Lina Khan, who wrote the 2017 Yale Law Journal article, Amazon's Antitrust Paradox. So she's even channeling Bork's antitrust paradox in her title. What is her basic case against Amazon? Because we see this more and more now, that Amazon is somehow a threat to our quality of life and our standard of living, almost at the exact moment when it, you know, when it has become ubiquitous, and anybody anywhere in America now can basically overnight, sometimes even same day delivery, get something, you know, pretty much anything they want delivered by Amazon. What is bad about that from Khan's point of view?
So Amazon obviously has been extremely successful in the marketplace and generating market share in a new segment, online retailing. And they are the acknowledged leader, some would say dominant or a giant, in online retailing in the United States. Still a fairly small fraction of overall retailing, bricks and mortar still being a lot larger. But of course, it's growing very, very rapidly. And the idea is that this is the wave of the future, and you don't have to, you know, be terribly subtle in your statistical analysis to see which way the growth arrows are pointing. So what she complains about, and others in hipster antitrust or the Brandeisian school would be concerned with, has to do with the nature of the competition. Obviously, there's been tremendous innovation and new choices for customers. But the allegation is that Amazon is too patient. They charge low prices to pull people onto their new platform, and they are undermining the companies that will be and should be and will no longer be their future competitors. And with the shifting allegiances of consumers, some of us who shop quite often at Amazon and have changed our lifestyles so that we don't have to consume gasoline and car time and stand in line at bricks and mortar shops, but use the conveniences of this newly emerging ecosystem. That delivers benefits, but it also allows a player like Amazon to exercise extreme economic power and, in fact, predatory power. That is to say that instead of just good, honest competition that lowers prices and helps consumers consistently over time, when competitors are eliminated, as they're being eliminated in this rendition quite continually already, prices will go up and consumers will pay higher fees because they'll have fewer choices left.
So the argument is that, and you mentioned Walmart earlier, this was the same argument that was often advanced against Walmart as it was becoming a fully national retailer in the late 80s and through the 90s, that Walmart will sell products at a loss now and suck it up. And then when they put everybody out of business, eventually they'll be able to raise their prices to whatever they want, because that's what a monopoly can do, right? A monopoly can just charge whatever it wants. So sure. It's a replay of that. And in the Reason article you talk about, it's funny, you know, for some of us who remember the last gasp of A&P, the supermarket chain that once, you know, bestrode America like a colossus. It had, from what I remember writing about this decades ago in a context of Walmart, A&P had a bigger market penetration at its peak than Walmart has had. But, you know, A&P, Sears, Roebuck, a variety of stores and chains that, you know, just dominated markets. You see the same argument again, that they will, you know, because they're big and you mentioned they're patient, Amazon is patient, they can wait out losses because they have all of this money and all of this power. And then they get to a point where they just run everything, you know, and that's the end of it, right? I mean, the hipster antitrust people are not saying right now that Amazon is brutal and bad, but it will be in some unspecified period in the future.
Sure. And we have to stop them now. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem, I mean, there are myriad problems with that. But by the way, let me just extend that argument over, because in fairness, there's a bit more to it, even at a high mm-hmm. level. And that is that Amazon, in creating the platform it now enjoys, obviously very, very popular in the United States and around the world, generating enormous retail sales, even with low margins, profit margins, generating lots of interest in capital ownership. That's why the value of the company is about $1 trillion, depending upon the stock market on mm-hmm. a given day. The platform actually serves hundreds of thousands, millions, in fact, of independent vendors around the world. And Amazon sells its own products on that same platform, setting up an instant and apparent conflict or potential conflict. That is to say, Amazon might use its information as the proprietor of the store to see what sales are doing elsewhere mm-hmm. and then stocking its own shelves and checking its own prices, perhaps reducing them, to undercut its rivals. And in fact, the argument in hipster antitrust is that this happens quite frequently, and that firms, small entrepreneurial enterprises, innovate, offer something great for customers, and then that information, that market test, is essentially appropriated by Amazon, that just, you know, stomps on top of these upstarts and drives them out of the market, making us all worse off with higher prices and worse quality over in the future.
Right.
Now, the problem with this is that, in fact, the independent vendors love Walmart. Excuse me, love Amazon. They also, to some degree, like Walmart now,
of course,
as a competitor
yeah.
to Amazon.
Right.
But they also like eBay as a competitor to Amazon. But in mm-hmm. fact, Amazon is, you know, now leading the pack. That is to say, they are selling much more of these third-party vendors online than any other platform, and they're selling a lot more third-party and making a lot more money on it than they are selling the so-called Amazon products. And I say so-called because Amazon, you know, in general does not manufacture anything. They contract for manufacturing.
Yeah, this and Elizabeth Warren has been very vocal about this, that you can either be a platform or a seller of something, but you shouldn't be both. So that she's talked about how Apple should either run the Apple App Store or it should make apps, but it shouldn't do both. And that somehow this, you know, this is a conflict that is, you know, that should not be allowed legally, where you can both be
right.
a platform
and
a seller.
It's okay to be eBay, but it's not okay to be Amazon.
Right.
I mean, eBay is pure. It has no interest in eBay products. And so you do have head-to-head competition amongst these third-party vendors. They have to choose. They can do both or, you know, focus on one or the other, and they do. And that's competition amongst business models.
And this, of course, has an analog in supermarkets and bookstores as well, where, you know, and to go back to A&P, their house brand used to be Ann Page, and you could buy, you know, Del Monte canned vegetables or something like that, or you could buy, you know, say at $1 for a can of peas, or you could buy Ann Page brand for 75 cents. So it's not as if this is totally new, that Amazon would be both a marketplace and a, you know, a platform and a seller in that marketplace selling Amazon basics. And they get a lot of heat for if, you know, if you say, I'm looking for a charging cable for my phone or something like that, and then they serve up an ad or say, why don't you look at the Amazon basic version, which is a cord that might be cheaper than a branded type of cord.
Sure. And what's happening over time is that the third-party presence on Amazon is growing dramatically. Amazon started in the 90s with essentially 100% Amazon products. Amazon contracted and owned products. And then they've gone from that position over the last 20 years to only about 42% of the sales items are Amazon offered and sold. And so the great majority now are the third-party vendors. That's growing. No end in sight for that trend. And of course, the site is extremely popular with customers to go to, you know, as their first online visit. And then that makes it valuable for Amazon. Amazon makes a fortune now with Amazon fulfillment services, where they accommodate those third-party vendors, and that's where most of their revenue.
They get a little bit of every time they send something out, they're getting something from the vendor.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they have listing fees, and they have shipping charges, and handling, and so forth. And
so,
the vendors are comparing eBay and Etsy, excuse me, and Shopify and their own native websites you know, to compare and contrast and see where they're getting the best marketing help and the best distribution. And so Amazon competes in that respect, and it's competing very, very well.
Is in this instance, then, is your argument that the hipster antitrust people are wrong when they say that Amazon is stealing business from third-party vendors? Or is it, does it not matter if they're stealing business from third-party vendors as long as customers are getting cheaper prices and more products?
Well, there's certainly a germ of truth in the idea that there's a conflict of interest, mm-hmm. that Amazon may have, you know, offering these different products, and they have different profit margins for their products versus their rivals. But the idea that therefore there should be a block on this is extremely anti-efficiency, anti-innovation, and anti-consumer, because there are, in many cases, great advantages to allowing the integration. And we're seeing that in the marketplace. It's what I mentioned in terms of eBay competing with Amazon. There's no right answer. eBay does not have a conflict. It does not have its own products. Mm-hmm. It's a third-party website. Okay, you get Amazon where you do have the conflict, and then you turn them loose. Look at Apple. You already mentioned Apple mm-hmm. having this integration into content with its iPhones and computers and so forth. Well, when that comes up in the early 2000s, they're immediately attacked by antitrust authorities in Europe as having some kind of monopoly or vertical foreclosure, as it's called, because of these restrictions. You buy mm-hmm. an iPod, no iPhones in 2001, you buy an iPod, you're stuck with iTunes as the content source. And that was considered controversial. The Europeans, that are notably different about Europe's antitrust rules than they are about, you know, Americans doing business in Europe and those antitrust rules, mm-hmm. they went after this American company for that kind of integration or conflict. But that was an enormous step forward in how customers, the iPod and computers, and then the smartphones to follow, how we are able to download music and video and interact with the internet distribution efficiencies to get content and applications. That was an enormously productive step forward, and has been written up in many books, including a nice book by Tim Wu, Who Controls the Internet, 2005, has a very, very nice chapter on that. That cleaned up a lot of the problems with piracy and billing and distribution, where we could get these copyright protected products over the internet. So this is a very important misstep to view this kind of integration as inherently problematic for consumers or the tech economy in general. And to have any kind of blanket regulation against it would almost certainly be very, very heavily harmful and anti-innovation. And the answer to all this is we do have rules against anti-competitive foreclosure. And those are the antitrust rules as interpreted by courts. And the idea that all through the Obama years, even though there have been members of the Department of Justice Antitrust Division then that are favorably cited for their public comments by Lina Khan as being favorable to hipster antitrust, they didn't bring these cases. In general, this was not. There are some investigations and so forth, but these cases are not brought because the burden of proof, which is appropriate, would have the government actually showing that consumers are being harmed by the practices, and that's the way it should be.
So what would be an anti-competitive action by Amazon that you would say legitimately deserves to be barred, you know, by the government?
Well, if Amazon were to go forward, say, and to merge with some multiple platforms, whether it be, you know, Walmart on the one side mm-hmm. or eBay on the other, almost certainly there would be an antitrust investigation of that. And again, depending upon how the facts of that market shape up, there would be a decision by the antitrust authorities possibly mm-hmm. to block something like that. In terms of the vertical restrictions that they have now, mm-hmm. there are some instances where those vertical restrictions have been shown to be anti-competitive. I've actually been, as an expert, an economic expert, witnesses in some of those cases back a few years back in cable television markets where there was some foreclosure in local cable TV markets.
Could you, draw from that? Like, what's a specific example? I'm just trying to, you know, I want to wrap my head around a specific example of a clearly anti-competitive action that a free market economist says, yeah, this was anti-competitive, and it's right that, you know, that it be forbidden by law.
So back in the 1990s, where they had local cable television monopolies, de facto, mm-hmm. not explicit, But you had franchise barriers in place that were imposed by municipalities and very difficult to get around to get competing franchises in the market. You had some cable TV operators signing exclusive agreements with companies like ESPN for products like Monday Night Football, which was the brand new, really, really popular cable TV product at the time. And the exclusive said, this cable operator gets access to this product in this market and no other competitor can do it. Mm-hmm. So this is what we call a rule of reason analysis, appropriately under the law, not a per se violation. There are efficiency arguments that could be made. And in this case, I thought that the evidence was on the other side, that in fact, that the ESPN, owned by Disney, the sports network, would actually want to sell to the broader audience, but that the monopoly power of the local cable operators was driving a contract term that said, no, the competitors trying to get into a market are going to be burdened by lack of access to this programming. And so there were some antitrust cases on that. In some cases, there were some positive results. And, you know, it's not that easy to win these cases, and nor should it be. It's, right. As I said, the burden of proof is appropriate. And it's also a problem in antitrust getting the right remedy, getting the judges to understand the economics and then, you know, impose something that actually helps competition go forward. So there are all sorts of other problems on that. But that's the kind of situation you have. Yeah. You can't even bring those cases now in the case of, say, Amazon, because, you know, we see that the cases are not brought. And by the way, the current administration is certainly looking at all these kinds of issues and has spoken very favorably about Lena Khan's work. And so it's not as if there's a partisan divide on that aspect. Certainly the political winds have blown in a populist direction. And while it's kind of disconcerting, this form of populism is aimed at consumer welfare, which you think might be a little curious just in terms of the targeting of the politics. But at any rate, the left and right are very enthusiastic about a shift in the policies away from the consumer welfare standard. And those cases have not, you know, to date, I'm not arguing that, you know, they should be, you know, I'm not suggesting, but they haven't, and there's a reason for that.
So would it be considered, or would you consider it, if Amazon said to a product manufacturer, you can sell on Amazon, but we forbid you, or you're not allowed to sell on eBay or Etsy or on any other online platform, including your own website. Would you consider that to be an anti-competitive behavior that might rightly be barred under a proper understanding of antitrust?
Well, again, not as a blanket categorical manner. And there are incentives that are given. Yeah. I've gone on the websites where vendors are trying to choose between, as I say, eBay and Amazon and other websites. And they talk about the incentives that you will be given by either platform, the costs, the benefits, the standards, both maintain standards for these third-party sellers. And it's interesting, as a consumer, without any skin in the game, selling on either platform, it's interesting to say that, well, they think Amazon's much tougher in terms of how they make sure that you don't have late deliveries and you don't have dissatisfied customers. They're tougher than eBay, and how tough that is on the sellers. And so, you know, as a consumer, you sort of nod and say, well, that's good. That's one of the reasons for Amazon's success. They're great customer service and, you know, the rules they impose. But they also give incentives to, you know, and they promote, in terms of their own online marketing, they promote those goods that do more business online. And when you have a situation where you're trying to extend those incentives to, say, a percentage of a small seller's business and trying to entice them, for example, to go in whole hog and give up their native marketing. In other words, jump on to Amazon, make Amazon the website. Well, Amazon likes that. It benefits because there are economies of scale. And so Amazon will share some of those benefits with the small retailers. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, that's great for the small retailers if they can strike those deals.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying
help Amazon a little bit, then help themselves.
Yeah, if you go in all in with us, we're going to charge you less. You're going to get more of the revenue that you generate. We're going to promote you more. We're going to, you know, you're going to be one of our stars as long as you don't dance with these other companies. That it's not clear. And what you're arguing then is that You can't have a kind of axiomatic rule that says that kind of treatment or that kind of arrangement is always and everywhere wrong. It needs to be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
Right. And that's the way a lot of the law works, and particularly antitrust laws, that in general, they're not categorical walled off parts of the world where there's just a simple yes or no rule. Now, you know, so what we're talking about now, the activity, as I said, comes under what they call a rule of reason, where you look mm-hmm. at the total, you know, consumer welfare benefits and add them all up. There could be, you know, negatives on there as well as positives. And now there's some things like horizontal collusion, which is called price fixing, mm-hmm. Where there are per se rules, where if you're engaged in, I mean, there are some sort of things to check off along the way to see what the market is and where the, you know, where the actual agreements took place. But in general, the agreement or coordination between direct competitors is problematic. So those that is a category. It's still somewhat general, but, you know, horizontal price fixing or collusion between direct competitors, that is, generally speaking, problematic mm-hmm. under the antitrust law and can result in, you know, certainly in a presumption. And in fact, a per se analysis, once that's proven, there is no efficiency defense to that.
So tell the story, which in the Reason article, it's in the October 2019 issue of Reason, which is available online. If you are a paying subscriber, you can get it at newsstands, etc. And the title of the story is called "The New Trust Busters Are Coming for Big Tech." It's like your 1,000th cover story in Reason. You've been a contributor for decades. But you tell the story of diapers.com. And this is often held up as a kind of cautionary tale of the way that Amazon, or a tech giant with a huge market share and, you know, deep, deep pockets, can suck up all competition. But it seems that when you kind of follow what was going on with diapers.com and the entrepreneurs behind it and where they end up and what they're doing now, it actually seems to be kind of a story about how markets really continually are innovating and kind of creating new categories of competition that benefit customers. So could you walk me through the, what was diapers.com? What was its relationship to Amazon? What happened, and then what are the people behind diapers.com up to now?
Yeah, so diapers.com was the brainchild, so to speak, of two New Jersey entrepreneurs, Mark Lohr and Vinit Bharara, and they founded a company called Kidsy, Q-U-I-D-S-I, Kidsy, for products related to kids back in 2005. So they went online. And they were, you know, tech savvy, and they did really well forming a company that included amongst its assets, most prominently, diapers.com. And so that website
for
did well.
For all your diaper needs, right? I mean, they were like, they were the superstore. They were a mile wide, you know, 10 miles wide and 10 miles deep on diapers online.
Sure. Well, you know, it turns out that diapers is a great product to buy online because mm-hmm. Probably you can kind of pinpoint the demographic. It's, you know, people with very, very small children who, you know, really don't have a lot of time to drive around and pick up mm-hmm. diapers. And yet, you know, their demand is going to be pretty constant over some period of months and years. So just sell it to them online. So anyway, they did. And it's, you know, it's a great entrepreneurial story. They figured out a very important efficiency about shipping. They had more very finely crafted box sizes so that when they put their products in the boxes to ship, they weren't using up a lot of extra space and everything worked much more cleanly. And that was one of the keys. You can go back and see all these great awards and kudos they got in the business press for figuring out the shipping efficiencies, just slicing little margins that the big companies didn't know about. So they did well. And what happens is that by 2009, just a few years in, they're outselling Amazon 4-1, online diapers. Who would have thunk? Well, at that point, actually,
it's diaper Dave, David and diapers versus Goliath, right? And they're kicking Amazon's ass. Okay.
Well, they're outselling Amazon about 4-1.
Oh, right.
So Amazon, in the story told by Lena Khan, they know everything because they have all the metrics. They know what's selling and what prices are and what, you know, their diapers. I mean, they're all selling Huggies and Pampers and mm-hmm. and, you know, the manufacturers are you know, perfectly clear to everybody in the market. These are the retailers. So anyway, Amazon, they compete more harshly. They lower their prices. They have some marketing campaigns, but these guys are still there. So Amazon buys them out. 2010, they take them off the market, and they're gone. And the implication is that some of these marketing deals that were offered by Amazon disappear, and by implication, the prices have gone up to customers. Let me instantly say, if that's the analysis, the prices went up, that actually is a step in the right direction. That is to say, it's good to look at the price level and if consumers are getting a better deal. And if you're worried about competition being stifled, that's what you ought to look at. It's actually against the grain of the whole analysis, which has been putting down consumer welfare as the concern and focusing too much on prices. But I just note that it's kind of an inconsistency in the argument. So let's go back and look at what really happened in this. First of all, talk about the buyout. The buyout came in 2010. It went to the Kidzee went to Amazon for about $550 million, and that's about $400 million of capital gain for the investors. So this upstart that's supposedly being disciplined by the market and kicked out to create a monopoly by Amazon is being paid an enormous amount of money to go away. And in fact, they didn't go away. They were bought by Amazon. The other thing that's kind of interesting, well, many things are interesting. These two young entrepreneurs got into business because they idolize Jeff Bezos. In fact, they referred to him at their office as the sensei. They wanted to be Bezos. He was their inspiration. And in fact, it worked. They got in and they were Bezos. They got bought by Bezos for over $500 million in 5 years. They were in a bidding war where Walmart actually offered them more. But they wanted to go to work for the sensei. After a couple of years.
Before we go there, what they do next, which is fascinating. Did diaper prices at Amazon go up, or do we know that?
Yeah. Well, I don't have, you know, Amazon's database on this, and I'm, you know, I did not do a deep investigation, nor is there one in the Lena Khan's Law Review article. I did go to the Google and find the 2010 prices, retail prices, and follow them through to 2019. It turns out that all the major brands have reduced prices by about 15 to 20%. That's what I found. That's what's there. So I'm very skeptical of the idea. There was no data presented really that suggested anything other than that.
Because that is kind of the classic monopoly theory would be Amazon, you know, either, you know, rubs out you know, their competitor or buys them out, and then they can jack up prices because they don't have any competition. And it doesn't seem, nobody has presented data that in fact happened. And there's your, you know, kind of cursory look actually seems to be that diaper prices continue to fall.
Correct. And of course, there are many other retail operations offering diapers online, including supermarkets, Walmart, and the native websites. And, you know, you don't have just Amazon there.
Right.
And in fact, what happens is that our upstart entrepreneurs, you know, the charm of Amazon wears off after a couple of years and they go their own way. And in fact, then Mark Lohr, he founds a new firm in 2014 called Jet.com. Yeah. And Jet.com is head up, just straight good old anti-Amazon competition.
Right.
And it's a retail website, not limited to children's products. And it takes off. And in 2 years, it is offered $3.3 billion to sell to Walmart, which he does. And he is today the head of e-commerce at Walmart. This is Mark Lohr, the billionaire, devotee of Jeff Bezos, a former employee and of Amazon, and a guy that apparently was an object lesson in predatory conduct by Amazon. This is what you do to get rid of upstart competitors. Well, if that's what you do to get rid of them, they're going to have some really excellent corporate messaging to overcome the story that their billions in the marketplace are telling, because that's not what people hear.
How did Amazon not write in a perpetual non-compete clause? It seems to me when they bought diapers.com, it's because obviously these guys are eventually going to come back and, you know, take you on in a different way. It's amazing to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, the answer to that is it's a contract, and you want to buy out the entrepreneurs forever. then you're going to have to pay more money. And in fact, there are some enforceability as the contracts get longer. And there are controversies, by the way, about non-compete clauses, which I think in standard terms run up to as much as 5 years. But it's very hard to buy off somebody for a career.
Sure, because you would have to pay them.
They're going to come back.
Yeah. So, and now we have this. I mean, it's a kind of fascinating moment of these two firms, then Walmart and Amazon, that were kind of intersecting in a for the first time in a big way in the 90s, where Amazon was attacked for destroying local bookstores and independent bookstores and things like
Walmart.
That. Amazon was attacked for undermining, independent bookstores or local bookstores.
Oh, okay.
Walmart was obviously attacked for destroying, local department stores, local chain stores, hardware stores, etc. And now you have Walmart, which is the single largest retailer, I guess, on the planet, certainly in the United States, and Amazon, which has something like 50% of the market of online sales, which are about 10% of all retail, and Walmart has a huge amount. Now they're sizing up in the 21st century, right? I mean, because they're now Amazon is getting into traditional retail and Walmart is going big on e-commerce. Is this a good thing or a bad thing for those of us who are mere consumers?
It is trade tested betterment. Consumers get to be the judge. And the fact that consumers are flocking to both ends of that competition tells us gives us some very important information. Consumers believe they're better off. Now, of course, we have independent evidence of that because we see that the efficiencies are real and the prices in real terms and the selection, the long tail that's available to us, in bricks and mortar stores, the amazing selection at a Walmart versus, mm-hmm. of course, the, just unfathomable selection. If, you're thinking about the pre-internet world that's now available online, all these quality and price metrics are available, but it's really the people flocking to the business. They have the choices. They can go to the other options, and they're giving them up. And they're doing so enthusiastically, obviously, because the customers think that they have efficiencies here that they're capturing. So unless you're going to take the anti-consumer Brandeisian view that consumers should not be able to make their own choices because we know best and we know in the long run this is going to collapse, then the evidence is, I think, very, very clear. And in fact, there's no evidence for Brandeis's position.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that Amazon is waiting to raise prices, the idea that you're gonna give away the store for 25 years and then you're 25, 30, 40, 50 years later, you're going to raise prices, that's an interesting argument. It doesn't pencil out very well. The fact is that they are doing well because the long run projection is that they keep gaining in the efficiencies and they keep going into new markets. For example, the cloud, which does not raise their retail prices but gives them access to a whole new set of efficiencies delivered to the economy, and online services that are developing. They have a tremendously productive platform for all of these options. So there's really no evidence of predation. All the economic evidence is against it. All the historical analysis would fall completely in that line. And the financial calculation you'd have to make to say you're going to lose money on all these units for 25 years and you're going to make it up on volume over the long run, that literally is a joke in business because that's not the way it happens. So, this is where we are. We're getting benefits from these kinds of competitive margins. We do have rules that say that if the margins go away and monopoly takes over to raise prices and lower output, that there are litigation tools in place, both held by private civil actors and, in the private sector and government regulators. And so that's where we are.
It's kind of amazing that the, you write in the piece how the hipster antitrust people, in the name of protecting the little guy, both businesses, but also consumers. And, one suspects that their heart bleeds, especially for people who have lower incomes and whatnot. But they're concerned that companies like Amazon and Walmart actually make meager profits. That they're, so it's this weird thing of, you're saying like Amazon is willing to not make as much money as they can for decades in order to make a big score somewhere down the road. And it's, it just seems kind of very counterintuitive for that, you know, for this to be kind of coming to the fore now. What do you think explains the embrace, at least among, and you were talking about, you know, it's in the Trump Department of Justice, it's, you know, Elizabeth Warren and progressive people, Democratic socialists talk about this. Tucker Carlson, the right-wing populist on Fox News, you know, loves hipster antitrust, at least as articulated by Elizabeth Warren. What explains the kind of elite embrace of hipster antitrust?
Well, yeah, it's a great question, although, you know, historically, there's no question when you hit, you know, you get the emergence of, you know, big, new, powerful institutions in society, they don't have the automatic social support that maybe some of the older institutions of society might have. And they are challenging. They're always bringing up new questions. And we have to make new decisions. I mean, the privacy issues that come up and how much screen time we allow our teenagers to spend with their smartphones. There are real challenges. And there's no question society has to figure out what you know, how to apply the old rules to new technologies and new markets. But it is, in addition to that, of course, interesting that there would be so much such consensus aggravation over the amazing new opportunities. And you'd go back just a few years. I was just reading something today in some tech journals that was published in 2012 about the amazing public data that was coming out of Facebook and how very informative that was and how good for society, and indeed praising, of course, the 2008 and the 2012 Obama campaigns for connecting the dots in terms of all the available public information that now is being considered, you know, almost scandalous. But very, very similar types of data releases to Cambridge Analytica that now is a great controversy was widely praised in the tech press just a few years ago as leading to a better world. And I'm not saying all the criticism is wrong, quite the reverse, actually. I think that we do need to take these challenges quite seriously and see where the, you know, the institutions are well equipped to handle the new questions. And then, of course, where they're not, then there will be law and there will be an evolution, both through common law and through statute, to adjust. And that flow is fairly natural. And we should have a reasoned and really factual, empirically based discussion. And that's what we need to have about big tech today. The benefits are real. The options consumers are exercising are extremely advantageous, as seen in what they consider, I'm using Deidre McCloskey's phrase, trade-tested betterment. They're lining up to get those long tails and those low prices that they can take advantage of. And we don't want to preempt that innovation. We want to accommodate it and to support it. And of course, part of the support, you know, involves pro-competitive policies. I haven't talked much about direct regulation, but also part of the Brandeisian view embraced by the hipster antitrust folks is that common carrier regulation in key industries and particularly for new technologies has been an important and underappreciated part of our protection. And that's a very curious argument given the problems we've had with monopoly with AT&T that was foisted on the marketplace by common carrier regulation, which was requested and obtained by AT&T as the incumbent operator, wanting those kinds of rules and barriers to entry and elimination of competition, and on, and airlines and so, shipping and interstate commerce. We've had problems with this, and deregulation has given us enormous competition and benefits. So we have to be very, very careful about those arguments there.
Yeah, you mentioned Google and Facebook, and you know, this is another point, the potential regulation or kind of you know, direct regulation of companies like Google and Facebook is another thing that is shared by people like Donald Trump and people like Elizabeth Warren, where they, you know, they talk about, you know, the need to kind of change business models or say certain things are okay and other things are not. You were the chief economist at the FCC for a number of years, and you've talked a lot about this. What explains, you know, why would anybody go back through history and say, well, you know, Bell Telephone, AT&T, like these were this worked well, or the idea of a heavily regulated industry, airline industry, this worked well. It seems like not that long ago that we understood that by deregulating that and by getting rid of common carrier rules, we allowed for a lot more stuff to be going on. What is going on that we are, you know, just as you were mentioning regarding Facebook and the way the Obama campaign used, you know, Facebook information to connect the dots, to reach out to people, to have effective political communications. It was celebrated up through, like maybe 2014, 2015. Now it's demonized, the same type of behavior. What's going on with this kind of economic, cultural, political amnesia?
Well, of course, we've talked before about net neutrality, which is in the background of a lot of history, and I trust and recommended by Lena Khan and others is a good way to consider how to deal with the communications technologies of tomorrow. And it is curious that's sort of the combination of wishful thinking plus history. I mean, history is forgotten. And so it's easy to throw it out that, in fact, AT&T lobbied for that kind of common carrier regulation and got it decades ago and used it to thwart competition. In fact, you go all the way back to the early days of the 20th century, there were actually a lot of competing phone companies. And AT&T Montbell only had about half the lines when, in fact, the government started regulating interstate telephone service, and the states came in to have public utility regulation take over for intrastate, and that was the end. That was the the system of one company, one system, universal service that AT&T ended up being a preeminent monopolist on, and in fact, getting busted by the U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division in a famous 1974 lawsuit as monopolizing telecommunications. Well, it really should be noted that AT&T was a regulated common carrier. And under that system, they had evolved and, in fact, operated for decades, in reality, as a monopoly that was there unnecessarily when we could have competition in long distance and even local, whether it be wireline or wireless. And of course, today kids grow up, you say, you know, this phone, this stuff used to be a monopoly, and people thought it's the only way it could happen. Really? That's what, yeah. You know, it's just, it seems so phenomenal. But we suppressed a lot of possibility with that. And it was not because of the market power specifically. It was the combination of the rent-seeking behavior by the incumbent who was successful in getting regulation and those rules. So, yeah, we have to be pretty careful about that. It certainly comes into many of these discussions. One of the things you'll notice, the hipster antitrust tries to blame Chicago, University of Chicago free market ideologues, for pushing antitrust in a pro-consumer framework. Well, it turns out that you go back just a few decades that there was great criticism of these regulatory institutions, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, and the Civil Aeronautics Board. This comes from Ivy League law schools, particularly Harvard Law School, far before the free market University of Chicago economists were even free market. There was complaints about the capture of regulatory institutions and the fact that the Civil Aeronautics Board was not allowing competition on the one side, and in fact, even wouldn't allow coach air travel up through the 30s and 40s, and in the early 50s, it was being commented on that they were trying to enforce first class fares only. And this was so blatantly anti-consumer. It had nothing to do with ideology. And in fact, the great deregulator from Cornell University, who had such a profound impact at the Civil Aeronautics Board under President Carter in the 70s, Fred Kahn, he considered himself a New Deal Democrat to his dying days, and in fact was not a Chicagoan, but was pro-consumer and knew that competition sometimes was thwarted by common carrier regulation, and it would be very socially progressive to eliminate those kinds of barriers to competition and allow markets to operate even imperfectly. If they could give some of the spark and innovation and pro-consumer fealty of competitiveness that is possible. So it was not a perfect competition outcome for Khan, but just a comparison to how effective government regulation was. And a lot of it had really been anti-consumer and had failed the test. And we saw how benefits skyrocketed in air travel and trucking and shipping when the Interstate Commerce Commission and the Civil Aeronautics Board were eliminated back in the last part of the last century. So anyway, so those stories are part of this development. I would hope people would remember their history and not impose in wishful thinking and basically a different set of facts.
Just as a final question, Tom, you know, you mentioned regulatory capture, and you talked about the way that AT&T went from being a competitor to saying, you know, basically lobbying for common carrier laws that they would then take advantage of. Does it, in the way that we've been talking, you know, the tech entrepreneurs tend to be kind of heroes of the piece, but does it worry you at all that, you know, within the past year or 18 months, we've seen CEOs and CFOs and, you know, CIOs of big tech companies, you know, from Google, from Facebook, from Twitter, go to Congress and say, sometimes explicitly, sometimes with a little bit of coding or euphemisms, but saying, you know, it is time to regulate us. You know, people like Tim Cook of Apple has said within the past 2 years, you know, the market is broken. Tech needs to be regulated. Are you worried that we're at a moment where the tech giants kind of realizing, you know, that there's a bunch of different games to play here, that they might be saying, you know what, yeah, let's Donald Trump, President Trump, President Warren, whoever, it's time to regulate us. And by the way, we are the people who can write those regulations the best because we know these industries the best.
Well, as an economist who studied this, you know, in some of these other markets, I get a little bit of a smile when I see it, because it is predictable that this is going to be part of the process. I often listen on satellite radio to CNBC during the day, and in the car and so forth, and I've noticed a skepticism developing about pleas for regulation from the tech giants. You know, there's some interesting social dynamics behind that, but good. I want people to be skeptical and to see what's happening here. So take Mark Zuckerberg. So Zuckerberg says, you know, we need to regulate privacy through a new federal agency. And that was one of the that made the anchors at CNBC smile and kind of giggle. Why they didn't articulate it, but here's what they were thinking. Let me offer, you know, make my psychological guess on that, and I think it's very profound. Mark Zuckerberg has a lot of control, let's put it mildly, at Facebook, and he does not need a government regulatory agency to tell him how to better protect the privacy and interests of Facebook users. They can do that, and they will do that to their definition of a standard at Facebook, according to Zuckerberg's views. What he needs regulation for is to change the rules at other companies. So that's what people catch instantly now. Okay? You want Facebook to be better with customers? Do it. And in fact, if a regulatory agency does come into being, you and I know, and everybody knows, and this is not controversial even, one of their first calls is going to be to Facebook. Come on in and tell us how your system works and how it could work better and what we should be doing. You tell us. Okay, not that we're going to do everything you tell us, but we have to find out what you're doing. The information is held on the other side of that table, on the private side, the private sector. And of course, regulators are not stupid about this. They constantly are trying to draw in that information and dealing with it. But in this kind of interplay, yeah, the regulatory institutions, they can do something that the private companies can do. They can force other companies to abide by the same standards and rules. And that sometimes is called a cartel agreement. Okay, doesn't have to be, can just be simple privacy standards. But that's the dangerous part, is that you can actually reduce innovation by allowing Zuckerberg to control not only what he offers customers, but what his rivals offer customers. And so the good part of what's happening now is not Tim Cook running to Washington to ask for regulation. The good part is Tim Cook running to the microphone and mocking the privacy protection at Facebook. And that also garners actually some giggles on CNBC, because they know what the deal is on that. They're just two different business models. You know, at Apple, you know, all Apple consumers, I'm one of them, we know that the deal is Apple says, how much money do you have? Give it to us, and we'll tell you what you can use. Okay, that's it. You give them all your money, and they've got a good solution from you, and you'll like it. At Facebook, they say, don't even bother bringing your wallet. Just come on, log on, and we're off to the races. The deal is, we get all your data. Okay, so these are two ends of the polar, you know, polar opposites, essentially. It's a freemium, and it's a, you know, a pay up front. And both of them work. Customers like them, different customers, sometimes the same customers for different things, and they're going to play out in the marketplace. I want them to play out there. And certainly I want competitors like Apple to point out that they've got some new mechanisms that are going to help us deal with too much time on the internet and the lack of privacy. And, you know, and that's the way we're going to discover the solutions of tomorrow. It's not by having Cook and or Zuckerberg sit down and figure out a way to constrain all of their companies to do it one way or the other. And that's going to reduce options and take us down a path that I think will be very detrimental to the options that would be otherwise available through innovation and competition.
Well, we're going to leave it there. This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. We've been talking with Thomas W. Hazlett, Clemson economist, the author of the cover story in the October 2019 issue of Reason, The New Trust Busters Are Coming for Big Tech. It's a deep dive into what is called hipster antitrust that is favored by people as varied as Donald Trump and Elizabeth Warren. Tom, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you.
Please subscribe to Reason Magazine. Go online, and for less than 15 bucks a year, you can get full access to digital issues as well as print stuff. And subscribe to the Reason Podcast. We're on Spotify. We're on SoundCloud. We're at Google. We're at Apple. We are at Reason.com. Thanks for listening.